Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. The Able Trust, believing growth and productivity of Florida depends on a diverse and inclusive workforce. The Able Trust encourages all businesses to include talented Floridians with disabilities as vital staff members. More information is at abletrust.org. WFSU-FM Tallahassee. From the state capitol, Florida Public Radio brings you Capitol Report.
As lawmakers eye a recently approved medical marijuana initiative, they have to decide what existing law to keep and what to scrap.
So I think the existing framework is an embarrassment and a disaster.
Also this week, the election of Donald Trump may have come as a surprise to many, but a former Florida governor and U.S. senator says it shouldn't have been a total shock given the mood of much of the electorate.
I think this past election season underscored how many Americans feel disengaged, cynical, that they've been disked, not listened to by their government.
We'll also get some insights into the growing battle between the economy and the environment in an otherwise sleepy North Florida county, and we'll discover that decades after it first appeared on the American landscape, too many people still can't bear to talk about HIV. I'm Tom Flanagan. This is Capitol Report. A strong majority of Florida's voters came together behind a constitutional amendment allowing medical marijuana. Now, as Nick Evans reports, Florida's lawmakers have to come together to roll out the changes.
Florida's legislative efforts in the realm of medical marijuana have been a slow-motion train wreck. After passing a limited program in 2014, regulators and nurseries sparred for 2 years over who should be allowed to grow the plants. In the meantime, the drug's champions and detractors squared off in the Capitol. Twice over measures to bolster the program, eventually settling on an expansion of the Right to Try Act, which grants access to terminal patients. It's been rancorous from the outset. Regulatory attorney Richard Blau explains, now Florida's leaders are on the clock.
The six-month period of time when the Department of Health and its Office of Compassionate Use are supposed to begin issuing regulations governing this new industry, that 6 months is a relatively short period of time for creating an entire industry out of nothing.
The department isn't exactly starting from nothing, but the amendment's demands are substantial. The list of tasks includes issuing ID cards and planning the renewal process, establishing standards for caregivers and treatment centers, and figuring out how much of the drug patients should be allowed to hold. But Jessica Spencer, policy coordinator for the No On 2 campaign, as a few other items she wants the legislature to address as it implements the initiative backed by personal injury lawyer John Morgan.
So Mr. Morgan specifically promised that this was only going to be for really, really, really sick people and that the legislature could outright ban pot candy and also that municipalities could outright ban pot shops from their cities and counties.
But Orange Park Republican Senator Rob Bradley is cautious about meddling with the state's existing hard-won regulatory framework.
There is a delivery system in place, ready to go. So I anticipating it being a smooth transition from what we have right now to a post-Amendment 2 world. And I think a lot of these issues have already been addressed.
So I think the existing framework is an embarrassment and a disaster.
Meanwhile, St. Petersburg Republican Senator Jeff Brandis wants to blow up the status quo. He and Bradley have worked on medical marijuana measures in the past, but Brandis compares the existing licenses to Willy Wonka's golden tickets.
I don't think that's right. I think we need to have a much more free market and open system. High, strict standards to get in, high requirements for safety. It's got to look, act, and feel medical, but there should be, for people who want to start growing, want to start producing, there should be standards which, if they can meet, they should be able to enter into the industry.
Florida's six existing dispensing organizations are likely watching closely to see which approach wins out. If lawmakers choose to do nothing, state law already includes provisions to add more nurseries once the number of patients cracks the 250,000 mark, but only three of them. Kim Rivers, for one, isn't eager to see the floodgates open. She's CEO of the dispensing organization TrueLeaf.
There was a high bar, and you know we've met that bar. I think personally we've exceeded it, and our hope for our industry is that the bar remains high.
Whether lawmakers choose to make a fresh start or leave the current framework in place, it seems the most likely area they could weigh in is the matter of other debilitating conditions. Opponents see that open-ended postscript to the list of eligible conditions as a major loophole, and even some supporters worry about nebulous symptoms, like chronic pain, becoming enough for a marijuana recommendation. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Nick Evans.
While the fortunes of his Democratic Party couldn't be much worse, the timing for former U.S. Senator Bob Graham's new book entitled America, The Owner's Manual, couldn't be better. The iconic Florida Democrat and his co-author Chris Hand spoke with Florida Public Radio's Jim Ash about their prescription for making government more responsive in the Donald Trump era.
It sounds like an interesting project, a little bit of profiles and courage and a how-to mixed in. How would you describe it?
I would describe it as timely. I think this past election season underscored how many Americans feel disengaged, cynical, that they've been disked, not listened to by their government, and they took it out in their voting pattern. Our book is designed to fill some of those voids by giving to persons of high school or college age a book which will help them master the skills that are essential for an effective citizen.
This presidential election, the results aren't something that you anticipated or even wanted.
I would say I was stunned by the results.
But, however, it's not something you could have anticipated when you put the book together, so that wasn't entirely the reason for the book.
No, we started working on this book almost 2 years ago. It's concerned me that there were 20 candidates who ran for president, and Trump and to an extent Bernie Sanders were the only two who seemed to get it, that they had heard what the American people were saying about their relationships with government. And then Trump was able to convert what he heard into a winning message.
Here's a chance for a mea culpa. Is there something you missed? Is there something your party is missing right now?
Well, I'm sure there were a lot of things that missed. But I will say I think that the work days, which I did for 30 years, were a significant anecdote. For instance, we'd had an extremely inefficient automobile inspection system. I had one of my jobs as a mechanic at a car repair place in Homestead, Florida, and that got me stimulated as governor to change and eventually eliminate that ineffective program.
The expectation on the part of most Americans is that you can't fight City Hall. You can't move government in your direction. In some ways, we think the most important part of the book are the multiple citizen stories we have. Those efforts can be replicated, and if we build and flex our citizen muscles, we can be effective in moving government in our direction.
I guess the lesson there is if people sit down and think about the issues they're interested in, they'd find they have a lot more in common with people that they would normally discount.
I think that's a very sage observation, that there's a tendency to think that the only people who will agree with you in the future are those who have agreed with you in the past.
In Georgia, we found they were very effective in fashioning almost a libertarian message in favor of solar, about freedom and not allowing the government and others to stop you from using solar power if that's what you wanted to do. It was that powerful message which not only impacted the Georgia Public Service Commission, but also the Georgia legislature, in the same way that it was the very sort of pro-business message that helped influence the Hillsborough County Commission to broaden its human rights ordinance. So coalitions are not just powerful in the who's a part of them, but also the messaging opportunities they create for advocates.
I've got to ask if you've spoken with your daughter since the election. Does she take any lessons away from Tuesday, or did you offer any advice?
Well, the advice was along the line that we discussed earlier, and that is keep your ears open so that you're hearing what people are saying, but you're also absorbing what they're saying. She has adopted on her own decision to do work days and has done quite a few of those, and through that and other means has kept a close relationship with the people of the 2nd Congressional District.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Jim.
Money might be a little tight during the 2017 Florida lawmaking session, but the state is slated to get $19 million to continue conservation programs tied to the 2010 Deepwater Horizon oil spill disaster in the Gulf of Mexico. The money going to the Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission is part of $370 million awarded this week by the National Fish and Wildlife Foundation's Gulf Environmental Benefit Fund for 25 projects in five Gulf Coast states, including Florida. Four of the projects are in Florida, by the way. By properly targeting funding from the Deepwater Horizon disaster, it can be ensured that Florida's recovery efforts are tailor-fitted to meet the needs of our wildlife and citizens, the words of Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission Chair Brian Yablonsky. The largest allocation to Florida, more than $11 million, will be for the state agency and Audubon Florida to implement a new beach nesting plan for shorebirds. Still to come on Capitol Report, Florida's prison agency is already putting together its legislative wish list for 2017.
There should be an across-the-board raise and perhaps an additional bump in salary for veteran officers.
Advocates say one of the first steps to addressing HIV in Florida is to talk about it.
It's hard to be too understanding of the overall politics of the situation, but ultimately they need to be open to the dialogue.
And it's the economy versus the environment as neighbors clash over the future of a little-known North Florida stream and the greater Gulf it flows into.
They need to clean it up, but they just flat refuse it.
Florida's largest state agency is asking the governor and legislature to up its budget by nearly $150 million during the lawmaking session that begins in March. As Sasha Cordner reports, pay hikes are among the agency head's top legislative priorities, and the union that has taken back the bargaining rights for the department's correctional officers hopes even more money will be forthcoming.
The Florida Prison Agency is requesting funding for four major issues. As in years past, maintenance and repair continues to be a huge priority. $35 million will go toward facility repair and renovation.
The department has the state's largest facility portfolio, spanning over 40,000 buildings and 20 million square feet of space. This request will allow us to replace over 80 buildings and 9 perimeter systems that are all more than 30 years old.
Kim Banks is the chief financial officer for the Florida Department of Corrections. She says other funding priorities include enhancing the mental health treatment of inmates as well as money to replace vehicles.
The department is requesting $4 million to continue replacing vehicles in our aging fleet. Currently, more than 75% of the department's fleet is eligible for disposal. This request will allow us to replace 153 vehicles, including transport vans and buses.
But the agency's most major concern is taking care of the ongoing problem of understaffing.
Our top priority this year is to hire and maintain critical staffing levels and to reduce certified staff turnover. We're requesting to do this through a three-tiered targeted approach that includes raising the base rate of pay for correctional officers and correctional probation officers, implementing a hiring bonus at high vacancy institutions, and raising the base rate of pay for our certified mental health correctional officers.
That's a nice start.
That's Matt Puckett, the executive director of the Florida Police Benevolent Association. His union just won back the right to represent the state's thousands of correctional officers and probation officers. They'd lost that right to the Teamsters Union in 2011. Puckett says more should be done to retain the officers.
The only thing that we would like to see added into that, and we believe we can work with the secretary and the department management, we'd like to see an across-the-board raise. And we'd like to see some money given to officers who have been there for a while, some veteran officers. You know, it's one thing to raise the base pay. It's one thing to focus on officers in particular facilities, but you should also reward officers who've been doing a good job, have kept their nose clean, and have been loyal to the department.
Still, Puckett says he is encouraged by the department's other requests to continue facility repairs and replace the inmate transport vehicles.
Both of those are important topics. The vehicles, that tends to affect the probation staff a lot more. They are in vehicles that have high mileage. A lot of them break down. So you have a dangerous situation for probation officers with the aging of the fleet.
Puckett says his union also wants to place an emphasis on the good work correctional officers have done, rather than what he calls the, quote, inexcusable behavior of others. He's referring to high-profile incidents involving officer misconduct that includes inmate abuse allegations and deaths.
You know, the Department of Corrections has had a really bad rap for the last 5 years. Unfortunately, less than a percentage of the officers get into trouble, and that kind of gives the whole department a black eye. And we hope we can turn that negative perception into a positive, because they're doing some really good work. They're doing it for very low pay. They're working long hours, and they're keeping us safe. And that's important to remember and to remind the public.
And he adds the FPBA is looking forward to working with the new Florida House and Senate leadership to remind them of the importance of correctional officers and meet all their legislative goals. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Sasha Cordner.
Floridians with HIV and their advocates are hoping to find community, friendship, and a place at the table this holiday season. We get that story from Regan McCarthy.
150 people are expected for a Thanksgiving dinner here at the First Presbyterian Church in Tallahassee.
Tonight's meal consists of ham, turkey, corn with a little bit of red pepper for color, green beans, dressing, sweet potatoes, mashed potatoes, bread rolls, and a phenomenal array of desserts. Desserts, and did we mention desserts?
Adonica Geiger is organizing the event. It's their Canopy Connection dinner for HIV-positive guests and their families. And Ann Westall, one of the original event organizers, says over the years, the guest list has grown.
Keep in mind, 20 years ago, AIDS had a different face. We had a very small attendance. People were uneasy about getting out and announcing by virtue of the fact that they were coming to the meal, that sort of announced that they were HIV positive. So as things changed, we began to get more and more people attending. Again, as the face of AIDS changed, then the face of our dinners changed.
John Padgett is one of the dinner's attendees. He's a peer advocate with Big Bend Cares, which provides education and support for people impacted by AIDS. Padgett says he's most looking forward to the stuffing, but also the chance to continue to build community.
Well, it's the connection with other people and just the fellowship that comes with it.
And Geiger says that's what she and other organizers had hoped for. The chance to help people living with HIV and AIDS, who in many cases still face a stigma, to find a feeling of connection within the community, with their friends and with their families.
Well, the main purpose, and I don't mean to be trite, is to have a wonderful time. Some of the people who join us for this meal, some of our neighbors, we've been seeing year after year for a long time, and it's really a joy to see them. It's a joy to see that they are back again.
But what about that growing guest list? In Florida, HIV rates have been on the rise in recent years, and the state is among the top in the country for HIV infection. But Charlie Adams with Big Bend Care says that's not necessarily the reason for increased participation at the Canopy Connection dinner, especially since local rates are fairly steady. He says more people could be coming for a number of reasons. More people were able to make the time or find transportation, or maybe fear of stigma is lessening.
God, I hope so. Any reduction in stigma, for whatever reason, however it comes, would be welcomed. The South is the South, and there's a lot that goes along with that. But here we are in a church, and we're serving people who are affected with HIV and AIDS from all these different counties, and everybody seems to understand that it's okay, and that's why we're here. And that seems to signal to me, at least, that there are people out there who are fighting the stigma. Whether or not we're winning, who knows? But I believe that we're definitely getting closer to a day when it's going to be never casual, but certainly more understandable in our community.
As far as the state is concerned, Adams says one way to address the issue is by being willing to talk about it.
I just think they need to be willing to have a conversation when it's needed. It's hard to be too understanding of the overall politics of the situation, but ultimately they need to be open to the dialogue.
Lawmakers and local and state health officials are working to address HIV infection in Florida. After receiving some pushback, lawmakers passed a bill last year that created a needle exchange pilot program in Miami-Dade in an effort to tackle growing HIV rates there. Adam says it would be great to see a program like that expanded throughout the state. No such bill has been filed yet, but lawmakers are just getting started for the 2017 legislative session. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Regan McCarthy.
There was much happiness and hoopla at the state capitol this week. Senator Joe Negron, Republican of Stewart, and Representative Richard Corcoran, Republican of Land O'Lakes, were sworn in Tuesday as the presiding officers of the Florida House and Senate. Negron will serve as Senate President, and Corcoran will serve as House Speaker for the next 2 years. Also, during an organization session on Tuesday of this week, all 160 members of the House and Senate were sworn in. The day before that, the Florida Senate held a ceremony to mark the completion of a multi-million dollar makeover of the Senate chamber. The renovation project began after this year's legislative session, with a focus on being finished before Tuesday's organizational get-together. The Senate chamber has been used since 1978. You're listening to Capitol Report from Florida Public Radio. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally this week, let's take a scenic trek down North Florida's Fen Holloway River. Now, if you've never heard of the Fen Holloway or you have no idea where it is, you can be excused because the river is so small, it's not even found on most maps. It meanders 36 miles through rural Taylor County before flowing into the Gulf of Mexico. For years, it was used for industrial dumping, a status granted by the state to lure manufacturers to the area. Today, the Foley Cellulose Mill is the largest of those businesses. For many local residents, the plant and the county are nearly synonymous. And when it comes to a fight over a proposed wastewater pipeline, most Taylor residents are choosing economics over the environment, as Lynn Hatter tells us.
Decades ago, dozens of families called the Fen Holloway River home.
My great-grandparents lived in Fen Holloway. My grandparents were in Fen Holloway. And my family, all of my siblings, grew up in Fen Holloway.
Longtime Taylor County resident Vivian Sheffield remembers life on the river. She says it was the type of community where everyone looked after each other. There was a tree swing and a special swimming hole, fish fries on hot summer afternoons. That was before the state designated the Fen Holloway an industrial river, before the Foley Cellulose plant came to town, before the river became fouled. Sheffield was in the fifth grade when everything began to change.
I moved from Fen Holloway when I entered junior high school. So at that time, change started happening, of course, and the river wasn't used for recreation purposes as much then.
In downtown Perry, big trucks laden with logs rumble back and forth. The signs of the area's main industry are everywhere, from Little Pine Pediatrics to Tree Capital Bank and the Cypress Mill Bar. Tax collector Mark Wiggins is keenly aware of the deal the county has struck between the environment and the economy.
You know, in 54, you know, what did Perry look like? What did Taylor County look like? You know, what was the poverty level? If industry comes and industry brings jobs, then industry brings health care, you know, is it worth sacrificing a body of water? I can't tell you the answer to that. What I can tell you is what it has done since they have been here.
The cellulose plant and mill directly employ 500 people. Industries that support it make up thousands more jobs in the region. The river runs through a golf course built for mill employees. The company backs local soccer clubs, schools, and charities. It participates in community development efforts, and it has the largest tax bill in the county. In the past year, Taylor and its residents, along with Foley Cellulose, have been swept into a fight over how to deal with the plant's wastewater. The plant is planning to build a pipeline to bypass most of the river and carry that wastewater closer to the Gulf. But opponents don't think that's a good idea.
They need to clean it up, but they just flat refuse it.
That's Clean Water Action Network's Linda Young, and she's not alone. Wakulla County Commissioner Howard Kessler despises the project, and he worries it could hurt the area's springs and Wakulla's fledgling oyster farming industry.
We're 20 miles away as the crow flies from the Fen Holloway mouth, so this really is right at our doorstep.
But the plan has already been approved by state and federal regulators, and the project is moving forward. Furthermore, what's going into the river now is not the same as what used to go in. The company has spent more than $100 million on river cleanup and restoration efforts, along with treatment upgrades to its facilities. It will spend another $20 million for the pipeline, which will run alongside and under roads and intersections, and eventually let out here at a boat launch.
What do you usually catch?
Trout, they got red. Too much work to do.
You redfish are in here?
Yeah.
Oh, sweet.
Huh. Speckled trout.
And do you
catch mouth?
Do you catch them and eat them yourself, or do you sell them?
Eat.
You eat them.
We're approaching the mouth of the Fen Holloway right here, and then you're at the Gulf of Mexico. So you can see the final discharge point is well away from the Gulf of Mexico, where it ends at Peterson's Landing.
Scott Mixon is the plant's spokesman. The river meets the Gulf about 2.5 miles from the dock where the pipeline will end. The plant's Chet Thompson heads up Fen Holloway management for the company. He says the restoration goal is to make the wastewater reach the same salinity as what's already in the estuary.
The color today, the changes have already been made. And we're monitoring for a water quality criterion called transparency, which is what color affects. And this is meeting that criterion today and is matching up with a system like the Ecofina, other Blackwater River. So this blackness is normal blackness levels.
Most Foley Mill employees are also longtime residents, and they know this river. They live, work, and play on it, and it has an almost sacred resonance to the people of Taylor County. The company says it's committed to continuing restoration efforts, and there's a widespread acknowledgement of the trade-offs that have come over the years. Tax collector Mark Wiggins says if he had to make the choice today of sacrificing the river to create tens of thousands of jobs,
I would probably say yes, and it would be very selfish to say yes, but I would probably do it only for the fact that I want to see this community grow. I want my children, if you moved here, I want your children to be able to come back to this community and put back into it what they got out of it.
And that's a trade-off most community members say they're willing to accept. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Lynn Hatter.
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Jim Ash, Sasha Cordner, Nick Evans, Lynn Hatter, Regan McCarthy, and Kate Payne. We also thank our contributing Florida Public Radio stations. Technical assistance for Capitol Report is provided by Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Follow us on Twitter at @FPRCapReport. And please join us again next week for more reports from the state capitol.
Audio copies of Capitol Report are available by calling 1-800-829-8809. You can also hear Capitol Report online, including archives of past shows at fprn.org. Funding for Capitol Report is provided by the following: The Able Trust, 25 years of connecting businesses with workers with disabilities. Businesses are encouraged to interview and hire talented and loyal Floridians with disabilities as they seek to broaden their customer base and reach all of Florida's diverse population. Abletrust.org. WFSU-FM Tallahassee. This is Florida Public Radio.